Now let's talk about some of the personal concepts of God that you're going to encounter as you get out in the world and as you have an opportunity to talk to other people and relate to them. Because it is the experience of most of us that every person you talk to is unique in that you can always find some variations of their own individual concept of God, even though they all think of God as the Father. So let's go back and think about God as the Father. I'm going to leave this up here because I would like to have you remember this, that whenever you talk about the universal Father, and this is exactly the technique used by the writers in paper 105. They use the word universal Father synonymous with the use of the word the I am. Is this a concept which is totally unique to the Urantia book?
The all of everything? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, the I am or the universal Father as presented this afternoon. The all.
No, I think I've heard that concept before.
Yeah.
Several. The I am concept in.
How about
Hinduism?
Hinduism. Very, very interesting. A work is one of the earliest Vedic writings related to the Upanishads, which appeared about 1000 BC. And in the Hindu literature, it was the first attempt to relate deity. First attempt to relate deity and cosmogony. Now, if we had gone on and talked about the proliferation of all reality, beginning with the appearance of Avona, concomitant with the appearance of the absolute personality, which is the eternal sun, and the appearance of Avona, which is the absolute of non-personal reality, we would be getting into cosmogony. And it was about 1000 BC that in the Satipatha Brahmana, the first Indian concepts of deity and a cosmogony running along with it appeared. It's also very interesting. About 950 BC, as far as present scholarship determined, the Hebrew writings, which were the recordings of, well, the recordings of verbal history, first appeared, which were later collated with some other writings that gave origin to the book of Genesis. So do you see the parallel? In India, about 1000 BC, we get the Satipatha Brahmana, and in the Hebrew writings, about 950 BC, approximately the same time, we have the origin of his first writings, as far as scholars can determine. What we've got here, now, is the genesis of two schools of thought, east and west. And we've got the same bifurcation in the sense that we've been talking about when we're talking about impersonal and personal deity. Because in the Hebrew writings, and the emphasis has been on personal deity, God as a person. In Satipatha Brahmana, the emphasis stayed on the Brahmana, or the Brahman, as impersonal deity. Now, it would seem on an ordinary glance, shall we say, that if you look at the Brahmana, and you look at the I am, in its original state of isness and nothingness, that the Hindu, 1,000 years B.C., started the origin of something that is just as philosophical as the concept that we have of the I am. Because the individual returns after transmigration and so forth, when he finally reaches the stage where he's capable, he returns to the Brahma, Brahmana, as a drop of water returns to the sea. Now, in the personal life of human beings, this bifurcation here has had a tremendous influence, because in our, there was a little bit of a variation here. You know, in the 6th century B.C., about 550, the Greek philosophers began to look out around the world as it is. They dumped the Greek mythology. Now, the Greeks themselves didn't do this. What I'm trying to point out is the magnificent intellectual achievement. And these are almost the terms that the Urantia book uses about these achievements of the so-called pre-Socratic philosophers, those who preceded Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Thales, Parmenides, Anaximander, Pythagoras. They began to wonder about the problem, which is still with philosophy today, of the one and the many. And they could look at the world and see the world, yes, the world has unity, and they could look out around among themselves and out over the Greek islands, which is as far as they could look then, and they could see all kinds of diversity. And that raises philosophical problems. So they began to look into the world to find their answers. And this is the beginning of the materialistic aspect of Western philosophy, and I think it reached, it was buried during the Middle Ages. The scholastics were pretty well able to bury it, and it emerged about 60 years ago in Vienna under the name of logical positivism, and we still have it with us today. Now it's called empiricism. But we've got to give the Greeks credit for being able to take the jump and dump their mythology, which was an exhibition of real courage to do this. That's really tremendous. So we have to throw in the Greeks here as materialists. Okay. The result has been that comparing Christianity to the Eastern religions is like comparing a personal God to a very highly integrated philosophical system. And they did a beautiful job, just a beautiful job. And the most philosophical religion today is that of the Hindu. Now, the Hindu has done what man does to all his religions. He monkeys with it. And so they've introduced a whole lot of gods, which had their origin as hearth gods and local gods, and they diversified it and convoluted. This had a very unfortunate effect upon the Buddhists. Siddhartha Gautama, the original Buddha, was in a way quite comparable to the Greeks in the way that he was thinking. He was looking for reality. And he ultimately was looking for a way to get away from reality. And he devised the best system of mental health that existed at that time and existed many centuries after that. If you read Buddhism and you follow the path, it's the sound of psychology that's been available for a long time. It's a good practical thing. Over in China, a chap by the name of Lao Tzu, he had a vision, which he called the Tao. The Tao is very similar in its generalities to the Brahman and to the I Am. Meanwhile, the Buddhists introduced a lot of subordinate deities, and they've got a complex religion, which now they are in, well, I am sure that most of you have read some Zen Buddhism. Actually, as I see it, sort of an effort not to complicate it, but to simplify it a little bit, depending upon one's point of view. But in general, the emphasis here has been on the impersonal all through the bouts of history, from the time the Brahman first appeared, whereas we have a very personal aspect to Western religions, and what have they done? They have proliferated. But still, in each one of them, the personal emphasis has survived, and the individual is considered to be worthwhile and to have a high value. And there is a difference, and people used to say a good many years ago, well, the individual is nothing in the Far East and he's everything in the West. That's an oversimplification, but that's the way that people used to talk about the two religions. Now, somebody like Albert Schweitzer made quite a study of Eastern religions, and because of this impersonal aspect, Albert Schweitzer called them pessimistic. That's Albert Schweitzer's opinion. There were lots of people who didn't agree with it. The Urantia book is going to appeal to Indians. Why? Because of the philosophical aspects of the idea of the I Am. Do you see the possible synthesis there? Do you see the possibility for blending? Do you see the possibility for personal contact? What I'm saying to you is if you talk to Hindus, don't talk about the Universal Father. Talk about the I Am, but know that you're talking about the Universal Father. Just a word of suggestion. Whenever you are talking to anybody about the Urantia book, just don't hit them with it. Try to find first, and this may take several meetings if you think they may be interested, and I think one of the greatest human mistakes that we make in disseminating or trying to disseminate the Urantia book is the same mistake that the government and the liberal religions have been making for years. They decide what other people need, say, without asking the other person. Try to establish a sensible, rational contact with other people. Go out of your way to attempt to learn their terminology, how they speak of things and what they mean. And if you start asking them, incidentally, what do you mean by this or what do you mean by that, you'll find them opening up. Opening up and opening out. And when you have reached the point where you can make a meaningful contact with these people in their terms, not yours, not the terms of the Urantia book, when you've got a common meeting ground of the same terms, that's when you begin to talk about not what the Urantia book says about the I Am, but you say there's a concept in the Urantia, if you're talking to a Hindu, there's a concept in the Urantia book, which is very, very much, so much like the Brahman, and I think they're practically identical. Again, do you see what the Urantia book has done? Meredith Sprunger told me years ago, he said, one of the things when I was younger, before I ever knew of the Urantia book, he said, I wanted to write a book which would be a synthesis of all the world religions. And he said, when I came in contact with the Urantia book about 1955 or 56, shortly after it was published, he said, I gave up the idea. Here it is. So, this is what you've got. It's right in front of you. The potentialities are just almost unknown. They have been barely opened up. And we need to read it more and more. Actually, what happens is that your appreciation of the book has changed with each reading. We now have the possibility to, hate the word, interface with other religions at their level. See, one of the problems of Christian missionaries was that they had to talk about Christianity to an audience that was not necessarily philosophically receptive to what they were talking about. Here we have something that is for everything. How do we interface with Buddhism? Buddhism is not only a religion, it's a very moral religion. So when we talk about morality, what does your Urantia book say about morality? Well, I will lead you into it. Crane Brinton in his history on Western morality, said, what is morality? He said, everyone has a set of individual ethics. And these individual ethics are what you consider to be your highest level of values. Now, they're way up here. Now, your morality is where you are every day. And that's always down here. Your morality is how you live your ethics. And your ancient book says the true morality is your sense first of cosmic responsibility, then of your responsibility towards your neighbors. Your responsibility towards other persons. To me, the Muslim presents the biggest problem. To begin with, he is generally militant. He means, that is, when he says Allah is one and Muhammad is his prophet, he means it. And when he says that there is no such a thing as a Trinity, he means it. You can still talk in his terms, because no matter how we have dissected the I Am, it's still, in the final philosophical context and concept, a monotheistic concept, because there is nothing beside the I Am, as there is nothing beside the Universal Father, as in our own experience, there is nothing beside the Father. If we take the I Am as being the reality of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and enclose them within the I Am, and say the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are manifestations of the I Am, and here they are operating in conjunction and unity and not as individuals, then you've got a Trinity concept. Whether you want to use that or not, again, the local condition, who you're talking to, their frame of mind, their reference frameworks is all going to determine that.
Do all these religions you've been talking about on the Eastern side, they believe in a soul or life after death?
Yes, because they have a paradise called Nirvana. The Parsi, that is the Persian, which is kind of borderline. That is the Hindu returns to the Brahma. This survival as a drop of water returns to the sea. It's still impersonal as far as the Hindu is concerned.
He loses identity.
He loses his individual identity.
Same with the Buddhist or not?
No, the Buddhist in Nirvana, this is kind of a state of bliss as it's defined. It remains a state of the being, but they're quite vague about identity.
Or what about the Muslims?
Is it separate or not separate?
Oh, the Muslims are karmas.
On the Western side, though, now, the Hebrew religion, do they profess of a life after death?
No. In the Old Testament, the reward for being true to Yahweh was material prosperity in this life. That was the reward. And I'm not so sure that they have any idea even today as a universal idea. I don't know, actually. I haven't checked it. But that's the Old Testament concept. Favor with Yahweh is always comes out as material prosperity in this life.
That's why Job was such a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Job was such a problem.
Right.
Because it didn't make any sense. Ah,
of course.
He doesn't. The thing went the other way with Job. It was a reputation.
The more religious he got, the poorer he became.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the more pains and illnesses he had.
Now, you think that traditional concept in the Jewish religion is carried on today, where I think a lot of people are beginning to think that maybe there's more to it than...
Well, like so many other religions, you've got so many shades now, and you've got the ultra-Orthodox who are shading into, or the fundamentalists are shading into, or vice versa, into the ultra-Orthodox, and the more liberal kinds that I don't think there is a single theology today that will explicate and give a unified statement about the entire Jewish religion. Okay? The roots of Muslimism are Christianity. Or the roots of Muslimism, well, according to the Arabic book, lie in the teachings of Abner, who established a very rigid, almost Calvinistic, by that I mean, no, it's not Calvinistic, but puritanical, code of behavior among his followers, that by 500 AD was becoming thoroughly repugnant to them. And Muslimism was a protest against that, and I look where Muslimism went. Just in the other direction, totally. And also, it took only with it the monotheistic, or the concept of a monotheistic God, and the idea of a material paradise.
It's funny that, you know, you don't find too many of them embracing both the impersonal and the personal.
No. Well, actually,
Except
putting the Muslim here because it has its roots here and in its, well, emphasis on materialism, it should still stay here. It doesn't belong over here at all.
And either in the personal or the impersonal, is there always a mediator between men, in other words, a priest or guru or something, between the average person and God? There's no real direct personal relationship with God.
Except to the Sardis gesture.
No, I mean in the religion.
Oh, wow.
It seems that a lot of the world's religions today, you know, have somebody that's...
Are you saying, is there a person?
Well, none of them seem to carry on.
An individual who would all assume the same spot as a minister, or a priest, or a rabbi?
Correct. In other words, so that, like, until my reading of the Urantia book, you know, I was brought up in the Christian religion, and, you know, you're direct, well, you can pray to God and everything, but it seemed that your relation was sort of intermediated by the priest or by the minister or something like that, mm-hmm. where he obviously was a lot closer. And it seems that perhaps, in light of today's world situations, a lot of the present those religions have the same situation, you know, have the same beliefs, where God, being personal or impersonal, measures his love to you, as opposed to being loving everybody equally the same.
Is that such a bad idea to have a teacher intermediary? You could,
well, if the teacher would remain a teacher, that would be wonderful.
Like Guru's two-car garage.
Yeah, but unfortunately, there's always the tendency, or rather historically, on the part of the teacher to become the prophet and the mediator, to begin to interpret the situation for the devotee and assume a position of authority in the whole thing. But the next thing we know, that we have a so-called priestly class.
But Jesus did it right. He asserted himself in that position.
Yeah. Well, after all, Jesus himself was the fourth epical revelation.
True, but can we, we're not going to get into magic then, but can we trust certain people to be our teachers?
I think you can trust people only to the point of where these people are dedicated and devoted to teaching only what they're supposed to teach. And also whether they are intellectually responsible. We're only taking an extremely broad look at all of these things. Let's take another step out. About 50 years or 75 years from now, you may be hearing, or you may not, but I certainly assure you that I don't think, well, there wasn't a comma after that, that I don't think that there's any possibility that you will hear it before then. Now, what's going on out on the periphery of theology today? What is being discussed in the seminaries and so forth? But before we go that far, I'd like to point out a rather interesting and something which is discussed in detail in this book. Two aspects of Christian religion which we are faced with today, and I'm going to be very brief about it, is then our liberalism and neo-orthodoxy. Liberalism tends to go in the direction of the social gospel. One of the first individuals to start this trend was a man by the name of Walter Rauschenbusch, who graduated from Rochester University back in the late 1800s. Well, he graduated from the School of Divinity, was ordained a minister, and took a parish in New York City, in what was then called Hell's Kitchen. Now, we would call it, in our language today, the worst slum of New York. And he went out there as a young man, and he took a parish there. And immediately, he got into a great deal of conflict internally with the theology about the goodness of God and the grace of God and the greatness of God that he was taught in divinity school, and the situations which he could see surrounding him. He did his best. He got himself in a lot of trouble between 1911 and 1919. He saw the condition when the garment workers, he did as much as he could to promote unionism. He did as much as he could to improve the lot, not only the people who were the parishioners, but all the entire neighborhood. And I think one of the most interesting statements that Walter Rauschenbusch ever made was, he said, "I'm puzzled about theology because it asks me to believe in my mind what I cannot accept in my heart." And in 1919, he wrote a book called A Theology for the Social Gospel. And in this book, he probably reached the apex of efforts along theology up to that time to generate a theology which was really a paean, so to speak, of his involvement in the lives of other people as a major program for the practice of Christianity. It's a very moving theology. In fact, it's still in print. But what this did was to turn the attention of churches towards a social program, to make the church socially conscious, to make Christians socially conscious. And it has been a very noticeable movement in Christianity, except that some churches have backed away from it. Now, to balance that off, a man by the name of Karl Barth, who got out of Nazi Germany in 1936 or 37 because he couldn't stomach the Nazis, began to write a series of commentaries on the Protestant religion. They run to 8 or 9 volumes, and it is a most in-depth study of the philosophy of Christian religion that's been written in the last 100 or 200 years. What Karl Barth says is almost shocking. He said, "Man can have no contact with God, that God is transcendental." Now, Barth, after actually years of examination of the Bible, came to certain conclusions. And that is that there can be no contact between man and God except through revelation. Now, but the most potent source of revelation is the Jesus of the New Testament. He does not, however, deny the Old Testament also as a source of revelation. Now, revelation can come to individual man only through reading the Bible. Now, revelation will never come to any man because he reads the Bible. He could be reading any book, and he wouldn't get any more revelation out of the Bible than he would get reading any other book. But if he reads the Bible in such a way that he is thinking about what he's reading, he is speculating, sometime or other, the light will dawn. But the only pathway to God is through the Bible. But he never says this, that the Bible is the Word of God. All right, you've got here on one side an emphasis on social service. On the other side, you've got an emphasis in the Bible. And all of a sudden, appeared on the stage, and this was on the stage in the United States. By the way, I'd like to, I think I'm going to digress here for just a minute. I can't go by without mentioning Reinhold Niebuhr, who many years ago, incidentally, when he was at Union Theological Seminary, I took a Urantia book to and spent a half an hour in his office. Niebuhr was born in Missouri. He was educated in American institutions and took a pastorate in Detroit. Well, this was long about 1912 or 13. His ancestry was Germanic. In fact, his parents came from Germany. His father was a theologian in Germany. 1912 and 13, that's 1914, and that time was when his first pastorate was in Detroit. And it was in the area where all of the workers at the Ford Motor Company lived. And he had the same experience in that particular neighborhood that Rauschenbusch had in New York. And Niebuhr is an interesting case because of the difference in the direction that his philosophical theology took. Dr. Niebuhr got himself very much involved with the Ford workers. And that was back in the days when the Ford Motor Company had its own security force. He got involved with the Ford people. He got beat up because he was up in sporting demonstrations. And he was a thorn in the side of the old Ford Motor Company. But one of his most interesting and philosophical works is titled Moral Man in Immoral Society. And it was an indictment of the society, the indifference, apparent indifference of society at that time to the common, ordinary welfare of man. And he preached this type of theology, this type of religion, from his pulpit in Detroit. And essentially what Reinhold Niebuhr had to say philosophically was this, that man is basically, internally, a moral creature. But when 2 or 3 or 4 or 50 or 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 people associate in a society, that the moral level of that society is always much lower than the individual level of each one of its component parts, each man, or each woman, each individual. He actually made sort of a theology about this. And here is another instance of sort of a combination between extreme liberalism and neo-orthodoxy.
Okay, the time...